is Wendy's Coffee House. My guest, Terry Lovelace. And I have been really, really looking forward to this interview. Incident at Devil's Den. That's what the story that Terry tells about his experience that he had in 1977. A story that, from what I've read, he never, ever intended to tell. And probably for good reason, because, you know, if you're employed and you have a real reputable background, credibility and all that, especially like mine in broadcasting, you don't talk about funky stuff that makes other people uncomfortable, especially when, you know, you're in an audience that is really having a hard time dealing with things like UFOs. Then we get into alien implants, and that just takes us on to a whole new level. So with this, we're also in the middle of a shelter in place for coronavirus. Of all the odd, amazing, interesting, unusual, unanticipated crises that we could bring to this equation is the shelter in place. And Terry Lovelace, you're on the line. I really appreciate you being able to talk about this. I know you were going to make an appearance at the UFO conference in Arkansas, and that has been delayed. We'll see how that works out. But, you know, congratulations. I'm glad you decided to just go ahead and come forth with a story. This is absolutely fantastic, and I don't know how you were able to deal with it for the what, 20, 40 years, since 1977, and not ever... Yeah, I mean, that's it. So, what's it like now, in the middle of this corona shelter at home? You weren't going to be able to go to the event anyway. You said you've been dealing for what, 2 weeks, is it? 2 weeks?
Yeah, you know, well, first of all, thank you for having me, Wendy. I appreciate the opportunity to talk to your awesome audience.
thank you.
Yeah, my wife and I have been sheltering in place. We've been isolated for 2 weeks now. You know, I take this very seriously. I worked in healthcare law for quite a while, and was general counsel for LBJ Tropical Medical Center, which is the American Samoa's only source of medical care, and helped to write an infectious disease protocol for the hospital. So I did a little bit of research to do that, and I got myself educated on the 1918 flu epidemic and realized that, you know, it killed more people by far the world than all the combatants, military and civilian casualties of World War I.
Wow.
So, it's nothing to mess with. It's potentially a very, very lethal disease.
Okay, so that's what I think, you know, in our society now, those of us who don't remember that and we don't have relatives who have survived that, it's on the far, it's like fiction. And so when I'm hearing people say, well, I'm going to stop at so-and-so and get a coffee or meet so-and-so out and, you know, we're going to dinner. I'm like, I think, well, how does this make sense when I'm thinking about going to work and our only employees now who can go into the, or are supposed to go into the building are the air staff and production people to help minimize the contact. And I was thinking, well, I put my gloves on and I'm okay going in and out of the building possibly. And then when I come back to the car, I take my gloves off, but my gloves have already touched the steering wheel, which then automatically puts me at risk.
Right. Well, you know, in medical terms, there's a thing called an R, like the alphabetical R.
Yeah.
R not. Like the British word for zero or Z, R not factor. And the R not factor is how many people will each person infect if they go about in the public. And this has an incredibly high R not factor, which is why it spreads so fast. And it seems to be maybe a different strain in Italy and maybe a different strain than we have here. But, you know, you fear that each person that goes out in public will probably infect four people, and then those four people will infect four people, and then it grows exponentially.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is why when you look at the graphs, there's an x-axis and a y-axis going up, and you see this line that goes across, kind of stable, and then you see this spike. And when you see it, it looks like a hockey stick, and it's like case, cluster, boom. I can't take credit for that. Someone else should use that. But that's the way it is. It expands exponentially. So
it's real.
You know, it's very real. Yeah. And we don't know how long for sure that the virus can stay active on a piece of glass or a piece of paper.
Right.
I know that China recalled all of its paper currency, every single note, every single one, and burned them and replaced their currency.
Wow. Wow. Because of that unknown. Okay. And see, that's what I've been talking to people. You know, if you're going to stop at the gas station, don't do those transactions. And remember, when you're putting that credit card in the machine, you don't know what's been in the machine. All these ways that the potentials that we have for messing up on this, it's astronomical, you know, just when you do the numbers on that. So anyway, I just wanted to address that because that's part of our reality at the moment and why the UFO conference and this is like, what, 30 some years in Arkansas, one of the best UFO conferences in the United States. And so to see it change is, there are a lot of people who...
Yeah, 33 years. And, you know, I was so disappointed because Nancy was really looking forward to having this year. And I got her email yesterday, as a matter of fact, the day before, saying that we made the decision to postpone it till July. You know, I hope July isn't overly optimistic. I hope that this thing burns itself out and we're safe in July. But, you know, we're dealing with an unknown. So.
Right. Right.
We'll have to wait and see.
Well, and like you said, that part of it is it's different in each country. And from what I've seen from some of the people who have been affected, it isn't just an old person's illness, because there are some people who are in their 20s who said, I didn't realize that I was this vulnerable. And so we're learning a lot as this thing progresses.
Yes. Well, you know, my friend Whitley Strieber.
Yeah.
I lives in New York City, and he CC'd me on the letter that he sent to Nancy, and he said, you know, I'm 74 years old. He says, I don't care to expose myself to this kind of danger.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that got the ball rolling. And
that's
I'm
good.
Glad that he did that.
Yeah, that's good. And I think that's it. We just have not had in our current generation this kind of threat. And so it's new, and to find out what happens from it, I hope that we have a best case scenario and don't have to go into a real severe, I guess, reaction with widespread illness. But I wanted to talk about, because of these things that are in our daily reality, this is 24/7, this is what we see in a manifest situation. But your experience back in 1977 is something that I don't know that you even entered that as a realm in the realm of possibility when this happened to you. So refresh, because the book is Incident at Devil's Den. And because of where it was, I've actually been down in that part of the country, driven through, and it's like fishing and hunting and all that, and Bigfoot, which I didn't know until after I visited a little, and this is a really cool place to visit, Board Camp Crystal Mine in Arkansas.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Well, okay, once I got there, they said, oh, by the way, here's our Bigfoot stuff. See that tree, that log in the tree? That's where, like, what? I was just going for crystals. So I got the introduction and experience. And I'm like, well, okay, I guess it's real. So there we go on the real factor, Devil's Den. Hey, Terry, now it's your turn.
Okay, fair enough. You know, when I wrote this book, you know, and I had no intention of writing this book. And, you know, I just, my wife and I agreed that it was something we would keep between us. We didn't tell our children. All they knew is that Dad would have these screaming nightmares once or twice a year. You know, and I have, I've been tested twice for PTSD and both times tested positive.
Yeah.
With etiology, PTSD etiology unknown. But there's only been one traumatic event in my life that I can think of. That was 1977. And,
well,
Devil's
okay.
Den State Park is an interesting place. You know, there's a guy by the name David Pilates.
Yes.
Ex law enforcement, very good author. He's written a series called Missing 411.
Mm-hmm.
You've heard of it. He was going to be at the conference. I was looking forward to meeting.
I know. It was a stellar lineup.
And the fourth book in his Missing 411 series is called The Devil is in the Details. And it's about this amazing collection of state and national forests and parks with the name Devil in the name. And how they have a higher proportion of people that go missing and disappear under strange circumstances.
Yeah.
And I just thought that was peculiar. And Devil's Den is in there, by the way. There's a famous case from 1946 about this little girl, 8 years old, who went missing. She was at her campground, went missing. And I'll make a long story short. They had thousands of people hunting for her. And on the seventh day of the search, it was going to turn into from a rescue to a recovery. On the last day of the search, this volunteer searcher from University of Arkansas was at an elevation of like 790 feet from where their campground was. She would have to take a zigzag trail like several miles to get there. She was 8 years old, dressed only in a swimsuit and flip-flops. And he calls out her name. Her name was Catherine Van Alst. And he calls out her name, and she steps out from this little limestone outcropping and says, "Here I am." She'd been gone 6 nights, 7 days, and other than a few bug bites, her hair was clean. She wasn't dehydrated, despite the fact that there was no potable water anywhere, and hadn't lost an ounce of weight. And couldn't recall how she got there. You know, didn't know what day it was, had no memory of anything. But just a very strange story.
Was that one, was there fog involved in that? Was there fog involved when she stepped out?
Not that I recall. I don't recall reading fog. What I did was I researched the newspaper articles. There's a 1946 Pittsburgh Press, because they came from Pittsburgh, article that followed it. And what's interesting is the Pittsburgh Press interviewed the mom, and they said, "Well, what's Catherine's mood like?" And she described her daughter's mood as, quote, "eerily calm." You know, that's kind of odd.
Yeah, really odd. Really odd.
Yeah.
Like something doesn't compute.
I really would like to have interviewed her, but that's, I guess, an opportunity lost.
Is she deceased?
I can't find her. I assume that it's likely that she is or married and changed her name.
Right.
There's all kinds of possibilities. So.
Well, and those cases that Pilates covers are absolutely incredible. I think the fact that they're national park issues and we don't report those from the national park makes it perplexing and really, I think, challenging for him to get the stories that he does. And also highlights that we really need to do better record keeping somewhere.
Yeah, well, you know, I tried to talk to the Park Service and, you know, get some history and some background, and I was just met with obstacle after obstacle. You know, I did finally, in 2017, when I was writing this book, there was a young man from Bartlesville, Oklahoma, 32 years old. His name was Rodney Letterman. And in August of 2017, he was walking with a friend along the Butterfield Trail, not far from where we had camped. And he had asthma, and he asked his friend to run back to the truck and get his inhaler just a quarter mile down the trail.
Mm-hmm.
So his friend runs back and grabs his inhaler, comes back, and there's no Rodney. There's just a cell phone laying on the ground. They bring in bloodhounds from the Russellville Police Department. Bloodhounds sniff his phone, and they sit down. So they had a massive search all through August, September, and October. And the family paid for private searchers. And, you know, used clear, you know, forward-looking infrared radar on helicopters, on light planes. Never found the guy until March of 2019. Right off the Butterfield Trail, sitting on a log, was a piece of bone. It was the top of his skull, sitting there in plain view.
Wow.
They had a DNA test and identified that it belonged to him. So, yeah, it's a strange place.
Yeah, nothing makes sense. Okay, now your story is just as astonishing. Can you set the background for it?
I sure can. My friend, I refer to as Tobias in the book, Toby and I were best of friends. We worked the night shift. We were both trained as medics and EMTs, and we drove an ambulance. So we worked in the emergency room at night, and I liked it because I was taking night classes and I could do my homework, and there were a few officers around. You know, we were both enlisted guys living in NCO housing on the base, and he was just absolutely fascinated with the night sky. He lived to watch the night sky. He knew all the constellations. He knew, you know, satellites when they would come over. He was just had this incredible interest in the night sky. So, you know, we made a good combination, became good friends. And one night he came to me and he said, "Hey, man, I got an idea. Let's go camping." And I'm like, Toby, are you nuts, man? You know, what do we know about camping? And I came from St. City. He was from Flint, Michigan. And he says, hey, man, look, it ain't rocket science. We buy a small tent. We buy a couple of blow-up air mattresses. We swipe a few blankets from the hospital here, and we go down and camp. And, you know, if we like it, you know, maybe make a regular thing. So we did, despite the fact that it was a long drive. It was over a six-hour drive from the base. And we drove down there in June of 1977. And I'll cut to the important part. We set up a camp right on the edge of the wood line. And we dodged the campgrounds. We didn't want to stay in the campgrounds because of the light pollution interfering with his star watching. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you're not going to take a picture. I wanted to photograph wildlife. That was my thing. So we came to a fence that was chained off, said no admittance. And I thought, oh, you know, we've got to find another way. My friend says, no, wait a minute. He hops out of the car and finds that the chain had just been looped on itself and locked into a noose and mm-hmm. just draped over that post. So he picked that up and dropped it to the ground.
Okay, and, okay, Terry, this is like the red flag. This is the red flag.
Oh, yeah.
Don't go there. Don't go there. This is the horror film where you get the first chill going, they're not going to. And then, okay, so he's taking the chain off and you guys are going in. Did you have any feeling about this at this point?
You know, we did. We were elated. I mean, we felt like Lewis and Clark. I mean, we felt like some kind of... Not a bit of fear. We felt like we were real outdoors, you know?
Yeah, yeah. Okay.
So, you know, I mean, when you're 22, you know.
Yeah, I know, I know. I've been there.
So we went in, and, you know, in retrospect, it was a little bit weird in that Toby almost had this unerring sense of direction, and he's like, you know, we saw a piece of high ground, and that piece of high ground is still there. I found it on Google Earth. And when you look at it from above, it's a triangular-shaped field.
Ah, wow.
And it's still clear-cut. There's not a tree growing on it. It's just grass, still, to this day.
Okay.
And it's a high point. You could see for miles. And we got up there, set up camp next to the tree line, built a fire, you know, did all the fun stuff that you do when you're camping. Mm-hmm. And, you know... 8 in the evening, we're kicked back on these air mattresses. We got a little bonfire between us. And, you know, this sounds so cliche because it sounds like it's right out of a horror movie. But I swear to God that it's true. And that is that all the crickets, the tree frogs, all the noises of the forest stopped.
Yeah.
And it got really, really quiet. And because we were having trouble even making conversation just a few minutes earlier because these things were so loud.
Right, right.
And I asked my friend, and then, man, is this normal? You know, like he would know, you know. And
you're both in a new place, of course. Yeah.
Yeah, he said, yeah, you know, we've been laughing and cutting up. They'll be back. The tree frogs, all that stuff, they'll come back.
Oh.
But I got to say, it unnerved me.
Yeah.
And, you know, had I been there by myself, I'd have been in the car and gone. But mm-hmm. I didn't. And about this time, he turned his head to the left, and he asked me, he said, hey, Terry, were those lights there before? And I'm like, what are you talking about? I couldn't see him because he was in the way. And I bent back, and over his shoulder, I could see there was this cluster of three, a perfect triangle of three bright stars, each one about as bright as a North Star.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't look like they belonged there, if that makes sense. They were too far off the horizon to have been like lights from a train or a parking lot or something.
Mm-hmm.
And they seemed to be static, so we watched them, and they didn't move, so we didn't think they were an aircraft. And while we're watching them, they rotated. They turned like they were on an axis.
Mm-hmm.
And then they went straight up in the air. Oh. And we could see, they were like just a trillion stars out that night. The sky was just a beautiful blue. And we see inside this triangle of stars, it was jet black, where the surrounding area was blue.
Mm-hmm.
And we watched this thing as it climbed into the air, and it's this tumbling thing where it went end over end. And I felt a sense of calm wash over me, almost like mild sedation.
Yeah.
And then I felt also, I felt inappropriately disinterested. I mean, it wasn't apathy, but it was darn close.
Mm-hmm.
It was more like I was an observer than a participant in this thing.
Kind of detached.
And we watched this thing. Yeah.
Yeah.
And you know, we should have been freaked out and running to the car, but we weren't. We were just kicked back. And we watched this thing, and it climbed, and it got to like a ceiling, a high point, and then you could see it start to descend. And as it descended, it got bigger. And but the three points always remained equidistant to one another. It was obviously, you know, one object, not three things, you know, acting in unison.
Yeah.
And we could see a shadow, because the starlight was so bright, we could see a dark shadow on the forest floor below us. And it moved and stopped directly over this little meadow and stopped at about 3,000 feet. And we both sat there and just watched this thing. And from the underneath in the center, there came a light. And it was a visible beam of white light. It had that quality like a searchlight cutting through heavy fog.
Mm-hmm.
But there was no fog. You could just see the light. And it was about 6 inches in diameter. And it hit our campfire and stayed there for probably 60 seconds. Maybe a little less, mm-hmm. and then like someone flipped the switch, it was off. And then there was this laser light that came immediately in its stead, and lasers were new in 1977. I had never seen one except on television. But this laser light would come and land in the campsite in an area and stay there for literally a tenth of a second and then reappear in a different spot. So it gave the illusion that this light was dancing all over our campsite.
Mm-hmm.
And I recall, you know, I had this feeling, hey, this thing's checking us out. But I still had that feeling of calm. And that lasted for about 3 minutes. And then we were both hit with this feeling of, man, all I wanted to do was go to sleep.
Yeah.
I was just incredibly tired. I felt heavily sedated. My friend felt the same way. And he just, with this thing 3,000 feet over our heads, and I mean, it was massive. I mean, it was like a Walmart.
Oh, wow.
He dragged his air mattress, he threw it in the tent, and just fell on top of it. And I did the same. I didn't bother to take off my boots or my shirt or anything. I just fell on top of this mattress, and I was out. And I guess I had been out, we determined later, somewhere around 4.5 hours. After the fact, we discovered both of our watches had stopped at 2:40.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they were mechanical wind-up watches.
Yeah.
And neither one would ever work again. I wish I'd saved mine.
Yeah, in retrospect. The other souvenir.
Yeah.
Yeah, the other souvenir, aside from the one that you're wearing.
Right. So,
okay, so, well, the thing is, you're both out. What time did you woke up in the morning? Did you feel anything at that point, or?
Yeah, you know what? I'll make this quick. I woke up to these flashing bright lights coming through the canvas of the tent. And it was green and yellow and flashes of white light. And they were very intense. They were like, you know, like a 1960s old school flashbulb that would go off and you'd see blue every time you winked your eyes for
right.
an hour.
Mm-hmm.
That's how brilliantly bright this thing was. And it woke me up. I'm confused. I'm like, oh, yeah, I must be at camping. That's where I'm at. That's right. And I'm thinking these are like, somehow the overhead lights of a park ranger's truck there to kick us out or something.
Mm-hmm.
And then I noticed my boots were undone. And I thought, that's not right. And in the military, they teach you how to take care of your feet. So I took my boots off and discovered my socks were on sideways. Now, that would never have happened to me. You know,
yeah.
That would never have happened to me. So that confused me. And I put them on correctly, laced up my boots. And in one of the flashes of the light, I could see that my friend had been crying. He was on his knees. He was peeking out the flap of the left side of the tent, and he's got tears running down his cheeks. And I'm like, Toby, man, what is it? Is it park rangers? And he doesn't answer me. a matter of fact, he goes, sure, and tells me to be quiet, whispers, be quiet. And so I want to know what's going on. I get to my knees, and I look outside the tent from my side, and I could see that this thing that had been 3,000 feet over our heads had descended, and now was about 30 feet over our heads. And it was just absolutely enormous.
Wow.
And the other thing that I noticed was that there were these kids. Well, what I thought were kids, about maybe a dozen or 15, and they were paired up in twos and threes, and they were just kind of walking around this meadow. And they all walked with the same distinctive gait. They had a very odd walk, like they had sore feet or something. They didn't walk with a normal human gait.
Mm-hmm.
And I asked, you know, I'm still a bit out of it, and I said, hey, Toby, man, what are these kids doing out here, you know, in the middle of nowhere, in the middle of the night? And I was still under that sedation or whatever it was.
Right.
And he says, man, those ain't no little kids, Terry. Take a look at them. They're not human beings. They took us. Don't you remember? They took us and they hurt us.
Mm.
And as soon as he said that, fear just rushed right back, and I was absolutely terrified. Yeah. And I looked again out the camp, out the flap of the tent, and he was right. These were not human beings. They had the large heads. They were typical, you know, like the gray aliens.
Mm-hmm.
You know, 3.5 feet tall and wandering around the meadow. And I was shocked, and I was absolutely terrified. And we watched these things, and what happened was there was, from underneath of this cleft, there came a light, and that was another column of visible white light. It was about 25 feet in diameter, perfectly circular, and it came down from this cleft, formed this column of white light, and these little guys would wander into this light, and they would dissolve. And they did that in twos and threes until the last two walked in and they dissolved. And as soon as they were gone, that light shut off.
Mm-hmm.
And then we watched this thing take off. And it didn't take off like a rocket. It just lifted off like a hot air balloon. And it rose straight up in the air. And the lights at the apex, at the points of each triangle, there were these multicolored lights running up and down what I call a light bar. Those all shifted from multicolored to just white. And I remember thinking, I bet that's what makes it look like a twinkling star when it's in the sky. And yeah. I don't know where that thought came from, but that was my thought.
Mm-hmm.
And we watched this thing till it was three dots of light, and then one dot of light, and then gone. And still no noises in the forest, still dead silent. And
yeah, the bugs were smart.
Bugs were smart, yes.
It's like, I'm invisible.
Yeah. And we were, you know, this sounds crazy, but I didn't want to leave the tent. I mean, the tent was just a piece of canvas over my head.
Yeah.
But I felt like it gave me cover.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't want to be in the open to run from the tent to the car. And it took us 30 minutes to get the courage up to make a dash to the car and drive back home. And we finally did. And you know, to this day, I will not walk across an open space. A big open field?
Mm-hmm.
No. I will walk a mile around it rather than cut across.
Wow.
Because I still have that feeling of vulnerability if I do that.
That's the PTSD. Okay, so with your friend, he had more recognition or recollection of what was going on. Did he write anything? Because I don't know how his life ended up. It sounded like it traumatized him more.
It did. Whatever they did to me, they gave him a double dose because we were both badly burned. I had probably the worst sunburn I'd ever had in my life, and it was on every square inch of my body. I mean, every square inch of my body. I mean, soles of my feet, under my arm. I mean, everywhere I was burned.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't blister, but I was burned. And we both had, because we got in our car, and it was just early morning, and we took off. And as the sun came up, I felt like I had sand in my eyes. I had what they call flash burn. I had, it's like a sunburn to the cornea of your eye.
Yeah.
But yeah, my friend, I think, had more recollection of it than I did. But we were both so miserable. And we were just in an odd state of mind. I don't know how to describe it. We drove the 6 hours we stopped and got something to drink because we were so thirsty. We were both really very, very dehydrated. I found out later we were classified as acutely ill until they got us rehydrated.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, we hardly said a word. You know, you would think two people going through the same traumatic event would want to debrief and talk about it. And but it wasn't that way. We didn't talk about it. Just didn't talk about it.
Oh, it sounds like basically you were paralyzed because, for one thing, this isn't supposed to exist. And the other thing, how do you talk about it when you don't even, you're still basically in, you're shell-shocked. That, to me, that's what that sounds like.
Oh, I think so, too. We were absolutely in a daze. I mean, I was felt confused. We both lived in NCO house. I dropped him off at his house, and I think all I said was, see ya. And he took his flashlight with him. We left everything at the campsite. I mean, he left his backpack there with his, that's how they found us. You know, they found that chain down on the ground, and then the park rangers drove in and found our campsite. And they found our tent, you know, the blankets. They found his backpack with his name and address on it.
Mm-hmm.
And they saw that his address was Lightning Air Force Base, and they called the base, and they said, you know, it looks like two of your airmen have been down here, and they got a campsite set up, and it looks like they're planning on coming back.
Yeah. Oh, not hardly.
No, but, you know, what that is, that got the security police involved, and then from that, the Office of Special Investigations, the OSI, got involved. Because they didn't know, they didn't understand. And I guess rightfully so, they thought, well, maybe these guys are growing marijuana out there or something.
Right.
You know,
mm-hmm.
So, which would have been, you know, a pretty bad thing to do back in those days, 1977. That would have meant Leavenworth.
Felony. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, had we been doing that then, but, you know, that wasn't at all what we were there for.
Well, I know. So isn't that odd when people think to go out and look at the stars is weird behavior? It's you know, because the stars, it's like I've been, since I was a kid, fascinated. I love night skies, dark skies, and yet that's considered odd. Wait a minute. So you're more, you know, you're tagged with doing something illicit and illegal because that's normal. Wait a minute. Okay, sorry, that's just an observation.
That's just a good one. No, it's a good one. And they asked me, what was your purpose? They sent two OSI agents to interrogate me while I was in the hospital room.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, well, I was there to photograph wildlife. And they said, well, how many pictures of wildlife did you take?
Oh.
And I'm like, well, none. And actually, I mean, Toby had a camera. I had left my camera at home, which I don't understand, but
mm-hmm.
I mean, that was the whole purpose of the exercise, was to take pictures, and I left my camera at home. But you know, the whole time we're watching this thing, it never crossed either one of our minds to take a photograph. Not once.
I
don't get
that. Well, okay, when you said that the animals got quiet and then you felt calm, I think at that point you'd been zapped. At that point, whatever frequency it was a frequency to basically disarm you. And so whatever then, as they became closer, and you said then you felt more somehow calm and tired, the initial thing, and then to check you out, you know, to see what else was there. It, to me, this it's almost like a fishing expedition.
Yeah, we were the fish.
Yes, yeah. Okay, well, so we fast forward. So you guys have had, you're debriefed, and how did you try to tell them that this was what happened, that there were ETs, little, you know, how did that?
Yeah, well, here's what happened is this OSI agent, there were two of them. There was a major and a captain. They showed me their IDs, and the major had this Louisiana-style accent, very distinctive, and you know, he was intentionally intimidating, I think, you know, and he said, you know, you boys got yourselves a little marijuana plot down there. Is that what this is all about? I'm like, no, sir. He says, well, you got a big bag of marijuana in your house? I'm like, no, I don't have any marijuana. You know, I test every 90 days or 6 months, whatever you guys want, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he said, well, then you wouldn't mind if you took a look around your house, would you? And I thought, well, yeah, I would mind. I felt like, you know, if I objected, that I would look guilty.
Guilty, right, I know.
Yeah. So I said, well, no, go ahead. So they did. And
found your camera.
They found my camera. They found my rolls of undeveloped film. They found my wife's 35mm camera, which, you know, had pictures of birthday parties and the wife on it.
Oh, yeah.
They took that film. They took the undeveloped film. And they looked through my negatives and my prints, because I had a little darkroom set up where I could develop black and white prints.
Uh-huh.
And this questioning went on for a while. The captain leaves. There was a nurse that came in, and the captain left. And it was just me and this major in the room, and he's packing his briefcase. And I'm thoroughly intimidated by this guy. And then he kind of drops this tough guy affect that he had and kind of looks like just like a normal guy. And he puts his hand against the door, because my head of my bed was right next to the door. He puts his hand next to the door. It's a private room. And he gets down next to my ear, and he says, son, I know. And you know, you two knuckleheads stumbled onto something out there, and I think you know what I mean. Mm-hmm. And I didn't answer him, because I wasn't about to say I saw a UFO the size of Walmart.
Yeah.
I knew what had happened. I'd be in a psych ward.
Yeah, that was the end of your freedom.
Yeah, absolutely.
Talk about lab rat.
So I didn't answer him. So he says again, well, I think you know what I mean. And all I want to know is, how many pictures of it did you take? Where's your camera and where's your film?
Wow.
And I said, sir, I never thought to take a single picture. I left my camera at home. You'll find it. It's on my kitchen counter still. And, you know, Toby had a camera in his backpack. The thought of taking pictures never crossed our minds. And he says, well, why is that, son?
Mm-hmm.
And I said, we felt ill that evening. We went to bed and got up early and drove back to the base because we felt sick.
Mm-hmm.
And then he turns on the tough guy affect again and says, I don't believe you. So it was harrowing. It was absolutely frightening.
Okay.
You know, when I was a straight kid, I'd never been in trouble before.
That's what I wanted to go back to. Had you ever wanted to do, when he was saying camping, you were saying, why? Something drew you there. And the other thing was the fact that you had only one intention of going to take pictures and then didn't take the camera. So from my perspective, something was baiting him, and then you're his buddy, so you go along. But then we get to the point when you discover, as you're jogging, a little attachment. Do you think you were picked?
Yes. I should tell you about that real quick. It's
okay.
A short story.
Yeah.
1979, when I got out of the Air Force in 1979, at the end of my enlistment, you know, this all blew over. Nothing came of it. And I got to finish my enlistment. I obviously got out of the Air Force and went to finish undergrad and go to law school. So I started running in 1979, because when I got out of the military, I noticed that I was studying, I was sedentary, I was gaining weight, and I started running, and I liked it. You know, I liked the endorphins. I liked the dopamine.
Yeah.
I noticed that every time I would run, I never ran marathons. I'd run 3 or 4 miles a day, but I ran every day. And at the 2-mile mark in my run, without fail, there was a spot on my right knee and lateral that would go absolutely numb. And it was about the size of a half dollar. And I could take a pen and delineate the edges of it. It was perfectly circular.
Mm.
And that numbness would last for about 30 minutes after my run and wear off. And I asked my doctor, I said, you know, I get this numb spot that appears on my leg when I hit the 2-mile mark in my run. And she told me, she says, you know, it sounds like a systemic reaction. Probably not. I wouldn't worry about it. You know, so I didn't until 2012, when I had a cyst under my knee. And I went to the hospital to get an x-ray. And I get all my medical care from the VA.
Mm-hmm.
And when they took the when they took the images of my leg, the tech was like, did you suffer a shrapnel wound or something? It's like you got debris in your leg. You got some kind of metal in your leg. And I'm like, no, you know, I've never left Missouri, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And she said, well, she called a radiologist down to look at it. And the radiologist insisted, he said, well, you had to have an accident and there'll be a scar on your knee because you can't violate the integrity of the skin and put a piece of metal this deep in your leg and there not be a scar left. Mm-hmm. He said, sometimes they fade and move and they're hard to see, but they're always there. And he rolls up my leg and he looks at my leg for 10 minutes and he's just absolutely dumbfounded. Mm-hmm. And he says, you don't have a scar? I said, yeah, I told you. And I said, doctor, how often is it that you find a foreign body under the tissue like this and there not be a corresponding scar? And he said, never. Mm-hmm. I've been a radiologist 23 years. I've never seen this before. And he showed me that x-ray. And when he showed me that x-ray and I saw that thing about the size of a fingernail with the two wires attached, mm-hmm. as soon as I saw that, I realized that lay right underneath where that numb spot was. And I knew then, as soon as I saw that, I knew that back in 1977, those things had put their hands on me. And that just changed everything. I decided I'm going to, you know, well, fortunately, I retired early. So I determined I'm going to tell the world about this. I'm going to tell my story. And, you know, fortunately, because I didn't know if they were going to charge me with a crime or not, I had the presence of mind to take notes.
Yes.
And I filled notebooks, you know, full of notes about what happened.
Yes.
So I had those to refer to when I wrote the book. Not that I really needed them all that much because, you know.
So, oh, but it helps. It helps.
It helped with details.
Yeah.
It was a big event.
For that, it also corroborates. Because you were able, you know, you had it, you took it. It says you didn't just make this up 10 days ago.
Right.
So, okay. Right. Now, so for anyone who's listening, the deal is you were a state's attorney, and that's a kind of a job with a whole lot of credibility and leverage on some playing fields. And if you had come forward with, oh, by the way, I have an alien implant and I was abducted by aliens back in 1977, that kind of would have made that history, don't you think?
Oh, I'd have been fired. I'd absolutely. You know, I was attorney general for two jurisdictions. I was attorney general in the United States Territory of American Samoa and then state's attorney for the state of Vermont. And in either jurisdiction, and I practiced law where I went to law school in Michigan. I had a law office in Lansing. Mm-hmm. Any place. You know, there are some professions where you just don't talk about those kind of things. I mean, I would have lost all my standing with my peers in the legal community. I'd have been fired from my job. And, you know, I'd have been a joke, you know.
Okay.
But you know what? I think that's kind of changing. I think that attitude is changing.
Part of it, though, I wanted to say that because there's a stigma that it only happens to people who are kind of on the fringe and maybe not too mentally coherent, and so that their story is questionable anyway. Well, and there's another guy I've talked to, John Foster, who's an engineer, and he had experiences, incredible experiences for 40 years, being taken and brought back in the whole nine yards, and when he remembered, he had three heart attacks. So the part of this about our, I think, fiction at this point, that this only happens to certain people who are really not worth listening to because they have no value in our society. And that's bunk. And I think that needs to go away because it's obvious that there are certain elements in our society that have some kind of attribute or asset that these others, that I don't think they're all the same group, are interested in. And some way, shape, or form, I believe you were supposed to be there or you would have had your camera.
I agree with that. You know, and I also agree, I think it's a very astute observation that there are more than, we're not dealing just one species of alien life. I think there are multiple, maybe dozens, maybe hundreds. I don't, but that accounts for the difference in stories. People
right.
see different things.
Yeah.
And, I don't know, you know, lots of credible people have come forward. I don't know if you've ever talked to Travis Parker or Travis Walton or Calvin Parker or Chris Bledsoe or any of them.
I haven't spoken to them. I've read their stuff, and that's why I'm interested in this, and I've had my own experiences. And so this is why, for me, getting the word out and beginning to get some kind of a frame of reference for the unique aspect that it isn't the same, it isn't for everyone a cookie cutter. They're all grays. They're all white Nordics. You know, this is a completely different, I think, aspect of our awareness that is beyond anything at this point that we're able to identify or put one neat and tidy label on. It is unknown, unexplained, and the only way we get information is by listening to people like you who've had these kinds of intense contacts that you can remember and that you did have a corroborating witness. Let's talk about your friend, because what happened?
Here's what happened to my friend. When we left that campsite to drive back, something had changed between us. I mean, our relationship was different. This guy was my best friend in the world, you know, would have, you know, done anything for the guy. When we got back to the camp, to the base, we were ordered to have no contact with one another. Very harshly, we were ordered. I was told you're to have no contact with Sergeant Tobias. You're not to send him any notes, communicate with him through any third parties. You're not to give him anything. He's not to give you anything. So they wanted us. They wanted us not to get together.
Yeah.
And share our story.
Mm-hmm.
But he kind of fell apart. You know, I processed this. It was difficult for me to process too. But I was fortunate enough. You know, I had a good support system. My wife. Of 46 years now, you know, was there with me, and I had a support system, and I came through it. And Toby, I guess, didn't have that. Or I think that, like I said, they gave him a double measure. I violated that order. They gave him orders to Japan at light speed, and they separated us.
Mm-hmm.
And I stopped by his house because I told my wife, I want to say goodbye to the guy. You know,
yeah.
And I really didn't want anything to do with him, but I wanted to say goodbye. So she stopped the car in front of this house, and I ran up to the door, same door I'd walked through 100 times before, and I just walked in, and his wife was just glaring at me. I found out years later that my friend told his wife, oh, this is all Terry's idea.
Oh, so, oh, okay,
so that's
yeah.
why I got the dirty look.
Yes.
So, but she heard this exchange, or pardon me, Toby was in the bedroom and heard this exchange. So he came out of the bedroom, and he was just I was shocked. He was a few inches shorter than me. He was always very particular about his appearance, and he was disheveled. He had on a dirty T-shirt, dirty jeans, no shoes. His eyes were bloodshot, and when he got close to me, he had vodka on his breath or some kind of hard liquor.
Yeah.
And he wasn't a drinker. Neither one of us were. And I felt like I should embrace the guy. I felt it would be appropriate, and I didn't. But we arranged this awkward handshake. And he looked up at me, and he said, it happened, didn't it, Jerry?
Oh, gosh.
It all happened.
Oh, wow.
And I said, and that was a very emotional moment for me. I said, yes, my brother, it all happened. And he said, why? And I said, I don't know, Toad. I don't know. And I looked down at my shoes and turned around. I left the house, and that's the last I ever saw of him. So that was the end of my friend Toby. He years later, I tried to track him down because I had his dad's name and phone number in Flint. So I called his dad, and I said, yeah, I'm Terry Lovelace. I'm trying to reconnect with your son. And he says, oh, yeah, yeah, I know who you are. And he says, I said, how's Toby doing? He says, not doing well. He's, we found out he went to Japan. He got out of the service in less than honorable circumstances and was divorced and was basically living on the streets.
Yeah.
And there was an odd, very odd thing that happened, and that was that a few years later when I was practicing law, I was working with a FBI agent. And we became friends. And I said, hey, man, you think you could help me find a guy I was with in the Air Force? He says, oh, sure. He says, if the guy's not a fugitive, I can find anybody. And I gave him everything that I had on Toby.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, here's the guy. See what you can find for me. He said, sure, no worries. He said, but, you know, it's not an official investigation. It's just between us. I'm like, oh, yeah, I understand. I understand. So, you know, a couple weeks later, he says, hey, meet me at this bar we'd go to every, you know, every so often on Friday night. And I met him there. And he's real serious. And he says, I've got bad news for you. Your friend's dead. And I'm like, my friend's dead? What do you mean he's dead? because, yeah, it was an auto accident in Flint. I'm very sorry. And I thought, huh. But, you know, I thought, you know, well, things like that happen. So I went to write this book in 2016. I started in earnest writing it. And I thought, you know what, I want to look up Toby's obit and maybe fly up to Michigan and visit his gravesite. So I got on and did some investigating on the internet. And I found that he was alive until September 4th, 2007.
Mm-hmm.
The FBI agent lied to me.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I mean, I knew FBI agents to be a cut above. I mean, they were truthful, you know, right. I mean, people right. you could trust your life with. And all I can think of is that, you know, somehow maybe my file was tagged or something.
Yeah, red flag somewhere. Red flag.
They didn't want us to get together after the fact. So all that time we had an opportunity to reconnect and put our stories together. But I don't think their government wanted that to happen.
No. And apparently, you know, the kind of question you got, the guy standing beside your bed, it would indicate that he knew more about what was going on there by the type of question he asked you. Just that,
yeah.
You know, that's suspicious.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So with all of this, and then you were mentioned before that you've connected with some of the guys, Christopher Bledsoe and, well, of course, Whitley Strieber, who've had these other experiences. You know, it's a very unique group of accomplished people who have some kind of ability that seem to attract interest from the others. Are we, you know, an experiment? Are we lab rats from your perspective? How, at this point, how do you reconcile this?
You know, I reconcile this because, you know, I scratch my head. I'm like, you know, look, I'm nothing special. You know, I mean, I'm just not that interesting, right?
Possibly.
And Lou Elizondo. Oh, I think that's right, actor. Lou Elizondo from the show Unidentified.
Yeah.
You know, Lou was the one that broke that story about the Tic Tacs.
Mm-hmm.
I'm also friends with Kevin Day, who was the radar operator aboard the Princeton. He's famous for the phrase, it's raining UFOs. But anyway, Lou Elizondo. And again, cliche time. I had these unmarked helicopters flying over my house.
Yes.
About 4 months after I put my book out.
Yes.
And I was looking for the IN number, the identifier number on these helicopters. And when I blow them up, occasionally I found UFOs in the background, flying discs and the like. And I can send you some photos.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay, so who's monitoring who? Are they monitoring the helicopters monitoring you?
Great question.
Or is it a screen?
Great question.
Is it a screen?
You know, they're circling my house. I don't know who is chasing who.
Yeah.
I have a feeling, my gut tells me, because of the UFOs can so much outperform a helicopter, that that the helicopters are chasing them. But these guys would come between 9 and 10 in the morning, and they did for about 8 months. And, you know, I documented it. I went out, I took their pictures,
mm-hmm.
I made a record of it. I had, I got a friend who's a history professor, but when he was younger in the Army, he was a helicopter pilot. And he knows everything about helicopters, right? So I sent him all these, a digital copy of all these helicopters. And he said, well, first of all, these are, you can see the guys in some of the shots, you can see guys inside.
Mm-hmm.
They were wearing white helmets. And he says, these are military. They don't, because military pilots have to wear helmets. Civilian pilots, disdain helmets. They don't like them. They think it interferes with their vision. But military pilots must wear them. And he said, these helicopters that you photograph have an anomalous light source, some kind of like weird thing on the tail. He says that I've never seen before. And so I told Lou Elizondo this, and I sent him all these pictures, and he came to my house for 2 days.
So, mm-hmm.
You know, he wasn't disappointed. We went out to eat, and a couple blocks from my house, and here comes this military helicopter, you know, about 200 feet off the ground, zooming right over the top of us.
Wow.
And so,
okay.
Yeah, that you know, And that lasted for about 9 months. And at first it was kind of cool. At first it was kind of fun, you know.
Cool in a special way.
In a special way. Yeah. But then you know what? It got intimidating. It wore us down. I mean, yeah. We sold our home. I intended to stay there, you know, forever. I sold my home and we moved.
Mm-hmm.
The first night in our new home, we moved maybe 8 miles.
Mm-hmm.
Sunday morning, I'll never forget, Sunday morning, 9 a.m., I hear the familiar thump, 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 thump. And my wife and I both woke up. She says, oh, no. And I ran outside, and there's a large olive drab helicopter 400 feet above our new house. And I raise up my phone to take a photograph, and it peels off to the left and takes off. And it was, you know, it was just their way of saying, we know where you're at.
Mm-hmm.
And I've not seen a helicopter since then.
Oh, that was just like a little question of, okay, just as long as you know we're watching you. Well, okay, good.
Yeah.
You know, you're on Earth.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, okay, so we've got to wrap up here. But my thing is that from other people I've talked to, that these other entities have a way of being able to create a vision of something that maybe we aren't seeing what we think. Our brain registers it as a certain thing when it really isn't. And you said the UFOs were in the background, but the visuals and the interaction you had with helicopters. Is there a potential that maybe they aren't ours either? They just look like what
That is a possibility. I mean, they may not be what they appear to be. You know, in my book, I talk about when I was a little kid, I saw these little monkeys in my room, you know, and it happened a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it wigged out my parents, and because occasionally I would scream. And, you know, I put my email address in the back of my book. And I said, if you've had an experience and you want to share it, write to me, and I promise I'll write you back. Well, I didn't know it, but I got to date, I have over 1,280 responses from people. I've got people that tell me, oh, yeah, when I was 8 years old, I used to see monkeys or rabbits or deer or owls, lots mm-hmm. of owls, or orbs. And I think these things can take on a benign appearance to not scare a child.
Yes.
I think that, you know, a lot of people have had that. A lot of people write me and they say, you know, I remember this dream from when I was 4. I mean, you know, what are the odds you're going to remember a dream from 4? I mean, can you remember all the Christmases, the birthdays, all that stuff you had? But you can remember this one dream?
If it's an odd dream like that, you betcha it won't go away.
Yeah.
Because it doesn't make sense. And there's something about it that sticks with you, like what you have experienced at Devil's Den.
Absolutely.
Okay, so I don't know when you're actually going to make an appearance because we're kind of in lockdown mode for a little while. But the cool thing is anybody can get your book. And Incident at Devil's Den. So
yes, I have it in book form with photographs and illustrations in the back. I drew pictures. And then it's in a Kindle version, which is real cheap. Or there's also an audio version that I did. Where I read the book myself.
Excellent.
So it's in my own book.
Okay.
But it's only on Amazon. But if you're locked down and you've got some time, you know, give it a read.
Use it productively. And okay, and the other thing too, they can contact you too, because these stories I think you should put out as well. I think this is stuff worth sharing, because it says we share these common unknowns, and the more we share the stories, the more we make them real and less of an outcast moment, because that's what's still being done by various groups to say this is
doing that. I'm putting them together in a book. Oh, and some of them which just blow your mind. I don't have time to go into them, but you know, there's a sort of commonality that runs through the core of the ones that feel really, really real. And they always start off with this disclaimer, like, now, you're not going to believe this, or please don't think I'm crazy.
Yeah.
And then they tell me these amazing stories.
Okay.
Unbelievable.
All right, so we're looking forward to that. You had an ETA on that?
Probably late this year.
Perfect. Perfect. Terry Lovelace, thank you so much. I love that you're going public. I like the fact that this is something that we can finally start talking about in the open without feeling like we're a pariah. And that we have to shut up.
Yeah. It's past the giggle factor.
So, well, I'm the show will be airing nonstop for free at Wendy's Coffeehouse Audio Boom. So Thank you, Terry.
Thank you, Wendy. I appreciate it very much. Anything happens, I'll give you a call.
Thank you.
Thank you.